This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Connecting the dots between unemployment and our paychecks. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Adrienne Hill in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Thursday, the 23rd of July. Thanks so much for joining us. The jobless claims this week were a bit of a doozy, a good doozy. Seasonally adjusted, fewer Americans filed new applications for unemployment benefits than in any week since November of 1973. Marketplace's Sabri Benishort reports on what that might mean for your paycheck.
A lot of people, actually most people, have been short on raises for the past few years. Or at least raises have been underwhelming.
When I heard I was getting a raise, I was excited. I thought it was going to be something great.
Anthony Tucker is a nurse technician on his lunch break. He got a raise a couple of months ago.
But when I saw my paycheck, it was only like maybe 1%.
Now, for Tucker and others, the jobless claims this month should be a welcome statistic. Fewer jobless claims means more people working. That's called a tighter labor market. It also means that there are other jobs out there for you to apply for if you don't like your non-existent raise.
It's all about supply and demand.
Harry Holzer is professor of public policy at Georgetown.
And the tighter the labor market, the harder it is for employers to attract and retain the workers they want and need.
So they'll have to start paying more. But if you look at average hourly wages, they have not, really. 2% growth, a smidgen above inflation.
That's pretty slow.
Lise Gould is with the Economic Policy Institute.
That's far below any sort of reasonable wage target.
But there's something those numbers are hiding. At least Gad Levinon thinks so. He's an economist with the Conference Board, and he's bullish on wages.
I think they're already starting to rise.
Levinon says the numbers we usually look at, you know, the increase in average paycheck, are skewed. If, for example, there are more low-paying jobs in the economy, well, that will drag down the average paycheck and will drag down the average raise, too. Levinon thinks this is the case because when you look at wage growth within individual industries, it's higher.
2.7%.
And when he looks at surveys that follow the same individuals over time, just peek into their paychecks, wage growth is even higher.
3.2%.
Now, it's important to remember that these numbers show wages may be getting better. It does not mean they are good. We might be waiting another year or two for that real juicy raise. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
GM reported second quarter earnings today of about $1 billion, and some of that profit came from selling cars and trucks in China. But the Chinese economy is slowing, and that's making Wall Street nervous, very nervous. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports.
It's not easy doing business in China these days. Stocks have fallen, in some cases by 30%. Property values are down.
You know, all American companies are getting whipsawed in China to a certain extent.
That's Barry Naughton. He teaches courses on the Chinese economy at the University of California, San Diego. He says U.S. companies are having to adapt to a more mature Chinese economy that is slowing down. But U.S. businesses are reacting differently. Some Wall Street investors are leaving the country. Nicholas Consonary is director of the Asia practice at Eurasia Group. He advises U.S. companies on China.
I see a big differentiation in views between portfolio investors and then the multinational companies. There seems to be, I think, a much more negative sentiment in Wall Street than in the corporate world today.
Consonary says Wall Street is used to double-digit growth in the Chinese economy. Now he figures it's growing about 5%, slightly less than official growth statistics from the Chinese government. Still, that's nothing to sneeze at. John Frisby is president of the U.S.-China Business Council. He says U.S. companies just have to get used to a more mature, slower-growing Chinese economy.
In the past, the biggest restraint on growth is maybe not having the capacity. I think for many companies, that era is behind them, and now it's more like you would see in other markets around the globe.
Frisbee says consumer demand in China is holding up, so companies like Starbucks are doing okay. But things are tougher if you're a U.S. business catering to, say, the fickle housing market. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
It was a bad day on Wall Street today for a lot of companies. After the bell, though, Amazon announced sales up 20% from last year. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. A Greek exit from the Eurozone has been averted, so no Grexit, at least for now. But there's another potential crisis brewing for the European Union, a Brexit. I kid you not, a British exit from the EU. Over the next 18 months, the UK government will attempt to negotiate an even looser arrangement with the EU than Britain currently enjoys. And then it'll hold a referendum, asking the British people, do you want in or out? Out campaigners say the back and forth in Greece has given their cause a major boost. From London, Stephen Beard reports.
The Better Off Out campaign is based here on the banks of the River Thames in a floating office and conference centre on board a former British warship.
This is a former World War I Q-ship used in the First World War to sink German U-boats.
Which, says campaign chief Rory Broomfield, is apt, since his mission is the defence of the realm. And as he ushers me into his cabin, I suggest his waterborne office may be appropriate for other reasons.
It's highly symbolic that the Better Off Out campaign is based in a ship, which could cast off any time.
Well, we certainly like to think of ourselves as being part of the open sea. The UK has always been a global trading nation. We export around the world. We're not tied to the European Union.
Churchill once said if Britain faced a choice between Europe and the open sea, it would always choose the open sea, facing outwards to the US and the rest of the world. After Greece, says Broomfield, the Brits have even less reason to look to Europe.
The events in Greece have shown what the EU is doing to its member states, how it's treating them, and, quite frankly, the appalling nature of how it's set up and how it's run.
Better Off Out is a deeply conservative group, mainly concerned about the loss of national sovereignty. But after Greece, the anti-EU campaign's been getting a boost from another rather surprising quarter.
The nose to the left, 228.
Here in Parliament, the opposition Labour Party has overwhelmingly supported Britain's EU membership. But that support may now be softening. Labour lawmaker Graham Stringer says many of his left-wing colleagues in the party are now thoroughly disgusted with the EU.
Clearly, Greece have got themselves into a financial mess. But rather than helping them through that, the European Union establishment has brutalised them.
He says Greece has been bullied into yet more budget cuts and radical reforms that can only deepen the country's recession and misery.
I think it exposes how centralised and autocratic and unpleasant the EU project is.
And do you think, then, as a result of these events in Greece, it is perfectly possible that the UK will vote to leave?
I have no doubt.
But that's not the message from the opinion polls. The In campaign still retains a clear lead. A majority of Brits still believe the benefits of being part of a large single European market outweigh the disadvantages. These voters, Dave Brocklehurst, Julian Murray and Patricia Hackett, are still planning to say yes to continued membership in spite of the Greek fiasco.
It hasn't influenced me. I will still vote to stay in the EU, but stay out of the euro. Keep our own currency.
Well, I shall be voting to stay in Europe, so that hasn't changed.
It hasn't made a difference to how I'd vote in the referendum, no. I think that I'll be voting for yes.
At their floating HQ, Better Off Out argues there's still 18 months to go before the referendum. Plenty of time for more euro disasters. But for now, the majority of Brits seem to feel they're better off half in and half out. Better off with the best of both worlds, Europe and the open sea. In London, on the banks of the River Thames, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
The line between YouTube stars and mainstream celebrity is becoming blurrier and blurrier. Thousands of screaming fans are out in force today at VidCon in Anaheim, California. It's a conference for online video makers. And Freddie Wong is among them. His YouTube channel, Rocket Jump, has more than 7 million subscribers. And he's one of the latest YouTube stars starting to diversify. Earlier this year, Wong signed a deal with Hulu for a half-hour-long behind-the-scenes comedy. Here's a clip from the trailer.
It's an underdog story about us making the transition from internet content to mainstream television content.
Hulu is on the internet, Freddie.
Oh my God, Anthony, shut up.
I'm just saying new media redefines distribution verticals, but that's fine me, right?
Move.
I sat down with Freddie Wong in an office in Santa Monica to talk about the business of making video content. A business, he says, that involves doing a little bit of everything.
We produce and create, we write, shoot, direct, edit, post-production, everything is sort of all done in-house. So we kind of harken back a little bit to kind of old school Hollywood in a weird way, but also we're weird tech startup and content studio all in one.
So when you've got 7 million YouTube fans, why move to a different platform?
Doesn't actually affect what we do on our end. At the end of the day, we still make the things that we make. And we found that like the best strategy in this very fluid marketplace is not to be tied in to any given platform, but to be able to make good content. And good content will be able to live almost anywhere. That's what we found.
Fans, he says, will follow. Plus, Wong told me, the ad revenue sharing model that YouTube uses, it doesn't pay enough to cover the bills.
The ad revenue world in terms of ads online is not so good, honestly. And, you know, obviously it's changing. Obviously people are watching less television. They're moving to various other platforms and that entire world will shift. But that shift happens slowly because there's so much inertia behind it. And so thinking about even all of our friends in the same space, everybody has a very hybridized model in terms of where their revenue comes from. And ad support and ads themselves end up being a relatively small percentage of their overall pie in terms of where they're getting things.
Wong says today it's a whole new world for content creators. In the old days, you had to go asking for money. Now you build your own audience and people with money come to you. Coming up?
I figured out these games would be collectible years before anybody else did.
The booming business of vintage arcade games. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average threw off 119 points, or 2/3%, to close at 17,731. The Nasdaq fell 0.5%, or 25 points, to finish at 5146. And the S&P 500 lost 0.5%. 12 points to close at 2102. On the busiest day of the earnings season, Amazon was down more than 1% before the bell. Investors were expecting the company to report a loss of 14 cents a share. Instead, as we mentioned earlier in the show, the e-commerce and web services giant reported a 20% gain in sales and a quarterly profit of 19 cents a share. That sent the stock soaring more than 17% after the bell. From the coffee clutch, Starbucks quarterly earnings beat expectations and the company brewed a nearly 3% gain in after-hours trading. Bond prices rose today. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 2.26%. You're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Let your employees know you've got their back by signing up for Gusto for payroll and HR. More than 300,000 small business owners use Gusto. They offer benefits like health insurance, employee onboarding, and more. Get your payroll taxes filed, deductions calculated, and your team paid fast. No more pain. Just the joy of running your business. Get 3 months free when you go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on new home sales for June. Want more pics from space? NASA releases new images from its New Horizons mission. And are you hungry and in a hurry? It's National Drive-Thru Day. Don't drop mustard on your skirt. Ugh, hate it when that happens. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace. I'm Adrienne Hill. ESPN has parted ways with a lot of its big-name talent recently, including Bill Simmons, whose contract was not renewed back in May. Now Simmons has landed at HBO. He'll host a weekly talk show and work on sports documentary projects. Kenneth Shropshire is a professor at the Wharton School and specializes in the business of sports. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Why does Bill Simmons make sense for HBO?
Well, for HBO, acquiring Bill Simmons, they're acquiring a brand. I mean, Bill Simmons is a name that's known in the sports industry, and he will have his followers come to HBO with him. So that's a great move on their part. The second piece of it is that it fills up airtime with proven content. I mean, he hasn't had a whole lot of time in broadcast TV in terms of being on the air. But there's a great expectation that it'll be successful with that. So I think those are the two reasons, just the brand itself and also the content that it'll bring.
Now, Simmons isn't the only big name who's out at ESPN. Colin Cowherd, Keith Olbermann, what's going on over there?
Well, these guys cost money. And I don't know to what extent this is ESPN saying, you know, we're like the New England Patriots. We can put anybody on the field, use our system, and we'll be successful. But certainly a lot of the economics of what's going on is having an impact, that these guys, the ones you've named, cost a lot of money. And anybody that replaces them presumably will cost a lot less. And in this era in sports where the rights fees, which is primarily what ESPN spends dollars on, have been going up and up over the years, that's something you can't change. I mean, you can't tell the NFL you're going to pay less. You can't tell the other leagues are going to pay less, and their numbers keep increasing. But you can control the cost on talent. So that, to some extent, may be a piece of it. But, you know, the other side is, you know, maybe it's just time for a change, and we've seen all kinds of reasons in the press about why that might be with each of these individuals. So that's part of it as well.
And what about this idea that's out there that maybe some of these guys, including Bill Simmons, have been a little too outspoken against the NFL?
That's interesting. And from their standpoint, sure, maybe it's more about being able to control their talent, to control what they tweet, control what they say on the air. And for Simmons, you know, HBO is kind of a blue ocean in terms of what he's going to be able to do there. There's a great deal of flexibility, it appears, in terms of how HBO lets its talent perform.
So does Simmons going to HBO signal something about HBO's interest in sports, do you think?
Well, HBO has always been a player in sports in different ways. But across the spectrum, across every platform that is media now, sports is the content that keeps the eyeballs attached, that keeps listeners or viewers focused because they want to know what the outcome is. They want to know what people have to say about it. They want to hear it the first time it comes off. So that's what's special about this town. And that's what's special about maybe what HBO is looking at doing. As I said, they've done a lot in terms of documentaries and boxing and other programming. So going further in this space is not that surprising.
Ken Shropshire, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Today, we've got news that health insurer Anthem wants to buy rival Cigna. It's a deal worth around $50 billion, and it's the second proposed mega merger in the industry in less than a month. From the health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports.
Carnegie Mellon economist Martin Gaynor has such a simple question about this new wave of potential deals. It's elegant.
Are these mergers going to make us better off?
Will a merged Humana and Aetna be able to do things more cheaply? Will a merged Anthem and Cigna be able to do something new? University of Minnesota economist Steve Parenti says the answer is probably yes. If these deals go through, companies will expand their businesses into different types of insurance, giving them a better sense of what hospitals are willing to take.
You now get to see, in a sense, exactly what providers are willing to take for a Medicaid patient that's low income, And in a commercial insurance patient, that's basically the best reimbursement you're ever going to see.
That leverage may be why Anthem's CEO says this deal would bring in $2 billion in annual synergies, otherwise known as cost savings. The companies say that could get passed on to us consumers. But Northwestern's Limor Daphne says if passed as prologue, when insurers merge, premiums go up.
This is a highly consolidated industry that has not delivered a lot of innovation historically. And to believe that more consolidation is going to serve us is to put a lot of faith in the argument that increased scale will bring us improvements.
What really troubles Daphne is that it's hard to enter the insurance business. So if insurers fail to deliver on these merger promises, it's not clear if anyone can step up and provide consumers with another choice. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
There's been no shortage of remakes in theaters near you, but a film opens tomorrow that plays on nostalgia a little differently. It's called Pixels, and alongside Adam Sandler and Kevin James, the film stars Pac-Man, Donkey Kong, and all kinds of other old-school characters. The fact is, even with all the amazingly advanced home video game systems out today, there's still a fondness for the classics, one that keeps the vintage arcade superstore in Glendale, California, going strong. Gene Lewin has an 11,000-square-foot warehouse and showroom where he sells everything from pinball to Pong, and I had him show me around.
So this is our working warehouse. This is some mostly pinballs down here. These are ones that we're working on.
And really, you are stacked up to the ceilings in here. I mean, we've got high roofs, and what's that up there?
Oh, those are some parts for video games.
How do you get up there?
With a ladder.
How long have you loved pinball games?
I started playing when I was 16 in 1972. All through my teenage years, I went to arcades and played pinball. I bought my first pinball in 76.
Wow.
And I still have it.
This one right here, the Jack in the Box?
Yeah. I was working at Jack in the Box at the time, coincidentally, because that's a Jack in the Box game.
Uh-huh.
And I was saving up money for new speakers for my stereo. And it was in an arcade that I used to go to. They were closing down, and they had all games for sale, and they delivered. And I still lived with my parents at the time.
What did your parents make of it when you brought a pinball machine home?
I put a deposit on it, and I told them I'm buying a pinball machine. They said, no, you're not. But they knew how much I loved it, and my sister talked them into it. 77, I put my jumping jack in a billiard place called College Billiards. And since my game worked better than all the other games, made more money than anything else, so I talked the owner into letting me take over the whole location. That's how I got started.
How many arcades did you own at the peak of your arcade owning?
I had five.
Five.
They were called Pinball Plus.
What was the golden age of arcade gameplay? When was it at its peak?
It started in 79 with Space Invaders and Asteroids. And it just exploded. There was like a video game boom. 83, the whole business kind of crashed.
Right. That was after E.T. came out, sort of the Atari, the whole market collapsed, right?
It was like in a crash until 85. There's a game called Gauntlet that came out, and I think that like brought the whole business back.
So did you keep your arcade business through the 80s?
Or? I did survive. I lost a few arcades, but I did survive. In 93, there was like another crash.
Was it just sort of console games got better than arcade games?
The PlayStation came out, and it was some arcade games were based on the PlayStation, so they were equal, and that really hurt. Plus, I think they lost their creative edge. I thought, you know, well, maybe it'll come back, but it really didn't, so I decided to start selling games in 95. I figured out these games would be collectible years before anybody else did.
How did you know?
Because I saw it happen to pinball. I had pinball machines that I would, like, part out for parts, and they were junk. And I would go to pinball shows and see, oh, these games are worth money now. So I started thinking after a few years, this is going to happen to video games too. And I started collecting them. And only me and one other guy in Chicago that I know of had figured that out. So we were buying them dirt cheap, knowing that in a few years they'd be worth money.
And what is the market like for vintage video games and pinball machines today?
It's good. There's a trend called barcades where they're opening up bars with classic arcade games from the 80s and 90s. People buy them for their home. They want to buy a piece of their childhood. And we ship them all over the country because these games are hard to find.
Wow. And these are not cheap.
No. Well, the video games are like around $2,000 and up, and the pinballs go up much higher.
because some of them are really collectible and they're worth $7,000, $8,000, and $9,000.
Yeah, I saw a tag from Mars was nearly $10,000.
Yeah, that's our highest one.
The Earth is under attack. An attack from Mars.
Are these things good investments? If I bought a tag from Mars from you right now, would it likely be worth more in like 5 years?
I think so, because they've been going up the last 2 years. I remember games like Addams Family, I was selling for $3,000 when I started selling games in the 90s, and now they're like $8,000 or
$9,000.
Wow. So they're like triple what I was selling them for 10 years ago.
What's going to happen to your business when you retire?
I don't know. I haven't thought about that.
Are you going to retire?
I'm not planning on it anytime soon. A lot of people, you know, hate going to work. For me, I always end up staying late, and my favorite thing is when I'm done working is to go over to the showroom and play pinball. It's pretty awesome.
One final note before we go today. When I was talking to Freddie Wong from YouTube and Rocket Jump, he told me that today, more often than signatures, fans want selfies. So these stars are coming up with efficient ways to take a bunch of them in a short amount of time. Apparently, at some of these conventions, fans form really big circles, phones out, and the stars run around behind the back of the circle, putting their head in shot after shot after shot. Whatever you think of selfies, you've got to admire the ingenuity. All right, that's our show. Today, the Dow threw off 119 points, or 0.67%. The Nasdaq fell 0.5%, or 25 points. And the S&P 500 lost 0.5%, 12 points. Kate Kincannon, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Patty Hirsch, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Adrienne Hill. Kai's going to be back tomorrow. Have a great evening. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.